So Scott asked me to come in and talk about microkernels and capabilities this week, which may turn out to be his gain and your loss.
Don't worry, we have recovery schedule for next
week. We need a cleanup schedule. So for those of you who haven't met me, I'm Jonathan Shapiro. Until, I suppose, last year, I was faculty here. I'm now running a company time that thankfully is doing pretty well so far. It's always a guess what happens next week when you have a new company, but so far so good. I want to start by backfilling two items from Scott's discussion on the access control matrix. Actually, before I do that, let me ask a question. How many of you have taken Scott Smith's programming languages course, kind of programming languages course, where you've learned about type systems? So if I use the term signature, do you know what that is? So Scott Dorey showed you a story in which there's this access matrix thing, and there's subjects across one dimension and objects across the other. Depending on who draws the box, they'll draw them on different axes, but it's the same idea. And then inside the box, you have labels that are the access rights, and this is intended to be read as, this subject has these access rights on that object. Of course, notice I'm pointing to a subject, which adds to the confusion. The reason we have to put subjects into the picture is there are operations on processes. So when we talk about one subject, which is to say process or threat of control, acting on another, the actee has to be considered an object for purposes of the
app.
This is a fine story. The problem is that no implementation of this has ever been observed in the wild. And the particular problem is that if you think about what happens in a system based on access control list, which is the model I know Scott has talked about in detail, what you'll discover is that there's an object, okay, and hanging off of it, there's a list, okay? And the access rights part of the list is approximately correct. Access rights are actually a shorthand. Right. They're a shorthand for a subset of legal operations. For example, a file has both read and write methods, if we're going to borrow object oriented terminology. What it means to have read-only access is that the write method is not in your signature. And the reason I'm appealing to that is when we talk about protections in language-based systems, we're not going to want to do the access write shorthand. We're actually just going to want to use a closure. So the access write shorthand is it's a shorthand for a closure effect, not just a signature. I'll do that in a minute. But there's this problem in this story, right, which is the matrix would like to tell you, oh, that list that's hanging off the object in an access control list system is a list of, according to the matrix, subjects and access rights. The books will tell you that if you take a slice through the access matrix horizontally, where the subjects have been written down the left side, so horizontally is across the objects, and that's an access control list. What's wrong with this picture? If you look at real systems, is that what you find? If you take the Linux ACL mechanism, right, and you use the right indentation to LS to show you the ACLs, what are you going to find on the list? You find access rights? Are there? You have a 50% shot on a yes-no question. Take a flyer. Because I promise you that the mistake should be distributed evenly by the time we're done with this rollout. By the way, I'll have my share as well. What? You're likely to find access rights because you do have things there that say whether you have read and write permission. And those are access rights. Do you find any subjects? What's a subject? What data structure in the Linux system or what entity in the Linux system corresponds to a subject? That's exactly the mistake. It's a mistake in the access matrix, not in the system. Subjects are processes, actors. They may or may not act on behalf of the user. Worse, they may allege to act on behalf of the user and not do so. The problem is, processes have no durable names, right? When you yank the plug on the system, barring saved memory, right? When the system crashes, these things disappear, and their names go along with them. And what that means is, if you were to store their names in an access control list, those names have no meaning when the system comes back. So if you look at the access control list, what happens is people who build these systems are forced to adopt a shorthand. The shorthand they adopt is instead of doing subject and rights, what they do is principal and rights, which is to say user. Now, what's the principal here? If the user ID, but why are we sticking the user ID in? Ultimately, it's a process that's going to perform the action. So it is a process about which we have to make an access control decision. How do we get from the user ID back to the process? Or if you prefer, how do we get from the process to the user ID that we're going to use to look things up? Each process alleges to be running as a user. And as far as the operating system data structures are concerned, that lie is upheld. So indeed, the process has a marker in it called its principal ID. And what happens is, in practice, in real implementations, we go down the list looking up the principal ID, not the subject. This is not merely an artifact of implementation. What has happened is that the access matrix model has been fundamentally damaged. When we took the principal ID, what we did was we induced an equivalence class on processes, objects. It is no longer possible to say, here is a particular subject that's running on behalf of me, supposedly, and I don't want it to have all of my authorities. The model, in real implementation, the model can express that, but the real implementation cannot. And there are two lessons here. One, the access matrix model does not describe reality. The second is, reasoning based on the access model therefore leads you to fundamentally false confusions, both about what is expressible in the system and about what is therefore enforceable in the system. That's bad. And in general, when you're faced with models of systems, it's really important to understand where those models approximate and how, and whether those approximations are significant or not with respect to the question that you're asking. For example, in Unix, there are billions of types of objects, right? And the access matrix model doesn't really differentiate different types of objects. If it does that at all, it's going to do that by introducing different kinds of rights. At least it's still possible to speak about rights on objects. And you can deal with a type issue by differentiating different kinds of rights. That simplification of the model hasn't lost any expressive power that we really care about. Unfortunately, the subject to principal reduction does lose expressive power that really matters. One of the unfortunate consequences of this, well, let me do step two about the access matrix and one of the consequences. You will see people in textbooks throw up an access matrix, tell you that the horizontal slice is an access control list, and we just established that that's not true. And they'll tell you that the vertical slice is a capability. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in some sense, an access control list is a set of pairs, okay, first element of which is an object, off of which we're going to hang the access control list, and the second of which is a set of equivalence classes on subjects, that is, principal IDs, and access rights. So what I mean by this notion S stroke P0 is S the set of all subjects, the partition on S defined by those subjects whose alleged principal is principal 0. I apologize because P is the notation we'd like to use for processes, and I apologize for taking that over here. I can't really come back to this notation, but I'm trying to draw you a picture of something else at the moment. But this is approximately the structure of an access control list system, and what I'm trying to emphasize here is that the representation of controls hangs off of the object. Each object is going to have a list attached to it. That's a fairly natural place to put it. There are really only two natural places to put this. One is to attach the controls to the object and then have the list contain subjects and rights. The other would be to attach the controls to the subject and have the list contain objects and rights. It's the same triple. It's just a question of which way you factor it for purposes of representing it in the data structures of the machine. It would be the same triple if it weren't for this principal reduction issue. And the reason people tend to attach things to the object is, in most systems, in contrast to the subject, the process, which is not durable and has no surviving identity across restart, the object does. The file still exists after the system comes back. The principal ID, still exists after the system comes back, and the set of rights is in effect constant, right? That's built into the design of the system, what the set is. All those things are durable, and that's a property that we need here. But just for the sake of discussion, let me just throw up the other way you could structure this. Oh, well, what I'm going to do, there's an eraser here somewhere, is I can refactor this structure. And all I'm going to do is I'm going to swap the subject position and the object position. Assume for a minute, wave your hands, except by magic, and I promise to resolve this magic no later than Friday. We're going to come up with a story that allows subjects to be durable. Because if we don't, we're going to have a problem that's going to push us back into principal reduction, which is an issue. So if we flip this data structure, what we're going to discover is that we now want to build a data structure in which we're going to attach to each subject a set, and that subject is a consistent pair, or the list on that subject, going to consist of pairs which are the object and the right. All I've done here is, well, I've done two steps at once, which was probably sloppy of me. I flipped these two fields, and I took the subject reduction back up, the principal reduction. So this is just a question of, I have a triple, and do I hang the two things off the object, or do I hang the other two things off the subject? It's purely a question of data structure representation. And so goes the story. The basis of that story, people will tell you, if you slice the axis matrix horizontally, what you get is an axis control list. And if you slice the axis matrix vertically, what you get is a capability list. Because the horizontal slice is the set of things that would hang off the object. I beg your pardon, I got this completely backwards. If you slice this graph vertically, you get the axis control list. Because what you're going to get is these sets hanging off of that object. I'd have done better to actually circle this one, huh? At least then I wouldn't get into the subject-subject confusion. And if you take the horizontal slice this way, then you're going to get object permission pairs, which is what we have over here. And most of the operating system textbooks that deal with this issue at all will tell you that this thing is an access control list, and this thing is a capability. And on this basis, they'll tell you that the two things are completely interchangeable. This is hogwash. It's a polite term for bullshit. Wrong. But at best, the axis matrix gives you a frozen snapshot in time of the state of the system. It tells you what's going on at some moment that never actually happens in observed reality when you got to pickle the system and examine it from a God's eye view. Obviously, you never get to do that in real life. It's a bad thinking tool, but you have to be suspicious to make sure it corresponds to reality. We've already established one way in which it doesn't, which is that the model is flawed. The second issue is, we are rarely interested in the state of a system in a snapshot of time. Were we to snapshot a system and examine it, we could certainly discover that some protection state existed that we don't care about, that we don't like. And to that extent, it's an interesting picture of the system. Of course, by the time we have that picture, we've already made a mistake that we were trying very desperately not to make, right? That's the picture. This is like the virus checker, right? It tells you that you've been hurt after you've already been hurt. This is only slightly too late to actually do you any good. Anybody who believes things can be quarantined, I mean, some things can, but as a general solution, it's not satisfactory. What we're really interested in is the question, when we first turned the system on, what was the graph that we started from? And as the system executed, how did this graph evolve? And if we can characterize what kinds of evolution are possible, I may be able to say, well, if I know the initial state, and if I know the update rules on the graph, I may be able to tell you a priori that it is not possible for the system to reach what's called an unsafe state. Now, people will talk about memory safety, but safety really means the system can't reach some state that you've defined as interesting. That is your safety criteria, the many kinds of safety criteria. If we're going to ask about how the graph evolved, and and the safety property, unfortunately, the term got taken. There's a so-called safety property, and the test is, given some initial configuration of the machine, first, can I determine whether some particular process can obtain some particular right on some particular object? Presumptively, what I'm trying to do is make sure that it can't. First test is, well, can I even figure out if it can? And then, assuming I can figure it out, what's the answer? Can it or can't it? First, is it decidable? And second, what's the result? So the bad news is, in most paper access control systems, it's not even decidable. All real access control systems, it is decidable. The access control is model, the answer is anything you get any right you want in two steps, is never the answer you want. The reason it's decidable is all real systems are finite. When you find an infinite system, call me. In the capability model, we'll talk about why. Surprisingly, the answer is it is decidable even in an infinite system, although I haven't observed one of those in the wild, and you can control the propagation of access rights. A curious result. I'm particularly curious given that almost every real system you'll see in the field is built on the access controllers model. The reason for that has to do with, I think, some early failed research that didn't work out in the capability world. The implementation successes in the access control list were what people needed was kind of informal and it was good enough for a long time, followed by a very large body of software which came to depend on access control lists and would now cost probably $100 billion to replace. And unfortunately, that's more than any company can justify to shareholders. In fact, it's more than any industry can justify to shareholders. So one of the reasons I'm interested in capability systems is I work in areas where security actually matters, not just alleged security. And I work in systems that are considered critical, right? This means that we're shooting for uptimes measured in decades, not minutes. And you can now get Linux systems that under load will stay up in minutes of weeks. You can get Windows systems that will stay up in minutes of hours, I think they're up to. And the fix in Windows systems, right, everybody knows Internet Information Server is unreliable as hell. If you add .NET, it only gets worse. So the fix is, restart it every couple of minutes. Restart it every 15 minutes, because then it doesn't accumulate enough crap to fail by itself. You know, from a certain pragmatic perspective, this is, in some sense, a viable solution. It's not a very comforting solution when the system we're talking about is your pacemaker or your flight control system. Restarting those is a little dicier than restarting your web server. That's why I'm interested in capability systems. And the tie into reliability is, capabilities are not just an access control mechanism, they're a structuring mechanism on systems. And I'll talk about that more. Okay, so that was what I wanted to hit on the access control list stuff. And let's see where we are. Come back, yeah.
Just out of curiosity, what specific systems are you using?
I'm not going to ignore your question, but why is it relevant how many objects they have to access?
It seems like you can't heard about the Micros penalties, which are going to need new one stream.
So the performance penalty argument has been a popular argument in the literature of operating systems for 40 years. Are you aware of any single element of data that sustains that?
I'm not.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
In fact, the evidence is to the contrary. So moral of the argument is when you're reading a technical paper, somebody makes an assertion. If that assertion is not backed by hard data, there's a technical term for it, and I've already revealed it. It's called bullshit. Unfortunately, when ideas are popular in a given field, bullshit is often tolerated by reviewers, because it satisfies their assumptions. But in this case, it's wrong. The data is, there is no evidence whatsoever the capability systems are slower. Now, having said that, let me be careful. That's because nobody has built a system that allows us to do an oranges to tangerines comparison. There have been fully operational capability systems in the past, but they weren't Unix systems, right? They didn't have compatible APIs, and so it becomes very hard to do competitive benchmarking. The reason they didn't have compatible APIs is because the existing APIs sit on these access control mechanisms and are damaged. You can either have compatible APIs or you can have secure and engineerable systems, but you have to pick one. If your top criteria is performance, my suggestion is take out all the protections altogether. You'll get back about 10%. That's the approximate cost of protection as recently measured by Microsoft using the Singularity system. And I will hazard a suspicion that the Singularity system is not as well tuned as some other research systems that. But I think that number is plausible and it's consistent with what people have measured for hardware-based protection. Here's another tidbit. This one I cannot give you a citation for. It's based on personal observation over the last week. Fire up a Zen machine monitor. You pick your favorite operating system and you run it under Zen. There's a nice little utility that Zen will allow you to pop up, which, by the way, is, at least in the Fedora implementation, is not too robust, but it's fine for this purpose. I will periodically tell you what percentage of the CPU your guest operating system is using. If you can catch it going above 15%, call me. It might be the case that a 10% CPU overhead doesn't matter when you've got 85% headroom. I don't believe that argument, because I do believe that there are machines in the world that are pushed to the wall. They're mostly observed in low-end applications where things are very cost-sensitive, in embedded applications. Your desktop machine has more computons than you can use in the rest of your life. Push to quad-core CPUs, here's the dirty little secret. Nobody has any idea how to write code that exploits them. Currency is the challenge problem for computer science. I will hazard a guess that it always will be. Get a message. Challenge people's assumptions, including, by the way, mine. Now, okay, go back to your small number of objects point. Why does that matter?
I am, by the way, going to agree with you ultimately and pull the rug out from under the piece. Let's play out what you asked.
So my thought was that in Peacemaker, it's got, you know, basically hold actions, hard, stop beating hard.
Let's take that up. Actually, it's very important if your software gets your pacemaker into a wedge state to be able to reset it. And that does involve, if not stop beating hard, at least stop thrashing hard. Okay, go ahead.
So it seems like implementing a full major security system. Okay.
So you're not making an argument about quantity of objects. You're making an argument about simplicity. And you're arguing that if the system gets simple enough, it's possible to just build it correctly. How'd you know? I'm sorry?
Cheney is still alive.
Cheney is still alive. What an unfortunate fact. yes. Maybe I will not play with that particular example since I don't really need another visit from the Secret Service. I prefer to talk to the computer security people. Yes, Cheney is still alive, but I'm trying to make a point about reliability. So let's assume that, yeah, it's a small problem. You can strip it down to a dedicated application that really doesn't require an operating system at all. It turns out real pacemakers are more complicated than you say. It turns out that they deal with interesting arrhythmias, that they're very often custom programmed to the user. In many cases, they are now programmed using wireless technology. It was recently shown that wireless technology on current generation pacemakers is readily compromised. So while I agree with you that Cheney is alive, there are certain parties who know how to build antennas who could fix that. And that's a sobering thought when you're talking about the second line to the chief executive seat. But unfortunately, they're currently unemployed, former employees of the Eastern Bloc to whom that might be a source of entertainment. And those people are now employed by the Eastern Bloc mob. And the difference between the Stasi and the Eastern Bloc mob is that the Stasi occasionally exhibited restraint. I mean, if you really want to push that example, I actually think there's some cause for concern in the case of Cheney. If you own one of those pacemakers, I don't think you have any reason to worry, unless you happen to get between the antenna and Cheney. Very low likelihood. But why does the number of objects matter? You're arguing for simplicity. Okay, so homework exercise for you. It'll take you about 2.5 minutes. When we're done, bag Mr. Dory and ask him about the joys of software verification and the likelihood that that approach would really be cost effective if it turned out to matter that your pacemaker was robust. The argument here is if you care about the result, you need a kind of a two-factor design. You need some help that will check when you've done operations and give you some sense that something has gone wrong. Nobody's going to claim that at the scale of modern pacemaker software, you're going to get it all correct. And anybody who does claim that is lying. And the last time I talked to the CEO of a major pacemaker company was not prepared to make that claim, although he would have denied it publicly. But you do want some kind of internal structural barriers in your system so that when something goes wrong, you have a chance to detect it and say, oops, better start over, better reset to some known state. A couple of ways to build that barrier. You can do it with OS-based protections using classical hardware techniques. You can do it with language-based protections, although there are hazards with language-based detections in current hardware. You rest on the assumption that memory is reliable, and it turns out it's not. What you want is some form of check, and we're going to argue about the mechanism of check, and there are plausible arguments on both sides. Turns out the costs are the same. Introducing those checks is going to impose system structure and some amount of complexity to manage the two-factor aspect. Turns out that if you've got enough complexity to do that, you've got enough complexity to run an operating system. That's a subjective statement based on my experience building operating systems. Other people might not agree with it. I claim it doesn't matter how many objects you're managing. Whether it's important that you manage them correctly. Now, having said all that, Your intuition is absolutely right. It turns out pacemakers are not a critical application, and that's why I no longer invite my students to install their software on their own pacemakers. It wouldn't matter if the software failed. The reason is that the frequency at which your heart has to operate, even if you have the misfortune of a dysfunctional heart, is very forgiving, right? If you don't pump blood for 10 seconds, it's not going to hurt that much. Now, the cost of rebooting an embedded system is not a big deal. The main problem is resynchronizing with whatever your arrhythmia is. So it turns out that the mechanism that's used by modern pacemakers is to do periodic consistency checks, and if something smells wrong, hit the reset switch. This is not a satisfactory solution for flight control systems, although actually it's surprisingly satisfactory for flight control systems until the introduction of the glass cockpit. In fighter jets, this doesn't work at all, because in a fighter jet, the wings go like this. They aim downwards, and if you think about pendulisms, right, on a commercial jet, the wings go up, and the reason that is that if the plane loses power, think about the Bernoulli forces, the plane is sitting at the bottom of a pendulum, basically in a stable configuration, and it will stay in that stable configuration until something intervenes. And there are two kinds of intervention. One is you recover control of the aircraft, and the other is you don't. Fighter jet, if you look at it, you'll discover the wings bend downwards. And the reason for that is maneuverability, right? The problem with the 747 is it can't get out of its own way. A fighter jet has to be able to dodge, and so its wings go down. And the reason for that is for the purpose of keeping it in a perpetually unstable flight attitude. And without computer control, what that thing does is hit the ground. If you take the control system away from the aircraft, it is not airworthy. Now, in civilian craft, the problem is that if you lose the flight control system, you're going to lose the cockpit. There are no longer hydraulic controls on high-end civilian aircraft. And increasingly, those no longer exist on low-end civilian aircraft. Increasingly, you know, your Cessnas are going to glass cockpits. That's an application where, you know, 10 seconds to restart actually is a big deal. Lose a lot of aircraft in 10 seconds. So, is it the case that this is motivated for pacemakers? I could tell a story that the answer there would be no. And I could tell a story that the answer there might be language-based protections, even if you thought that it was yes. The problem with language-based detections is that most of them require a runtime type checking. They rely on runtime type checking. Runtime type checking is only as good as the reliability of your memory. There are these things called particle hits that have a root habit of flipping bits. Some small percentage of them flip bits in ways that still look good. If you want to find out about the practical application of this problem, do a Google search for Java and hairdryer. It's been demonstrated that by pointing a hairdryer at the DRAM of a computer, you can cause an allegedly secure Java system to be violated with pretty much 100% reliability in minutes. It's not that anybody's going to point a hairdryer at your pacemaker. I have no idea if anybody's going to point a hairdresser at your pacemaker. I'm thinking I shouldn't go there. But what's really happening with the hairdryer is it's increasing the rate of error effects. The error effects exist in the wild under ambient conditions, and they are observed. We actually have software checks in our operating system that in the late 1990s were catching 4 or 5 of these a year. Dimensional RAMs. So people aren't shipping error-correcting memories, and so given these error rates, reliance on pure language mechanisms has to be thought about a little bit carefully. I'm not saying it's a bad idea, I'm saying you've got to do your engineering trade-off analysis carefully. Okay. Since I managed to eat through all of my time today, give or take 12 minutes, let me hit you with a couple of probing questions leading up to Wednesday. Scott, I think, has introduced the idea of a microkernel. What did you say about microkernel? I don't know that term split, so what do you mean by that?
Basically, a microkernel being the set of things go into a microkernel. Right.
So you talk much about motivation. If I were to ask you how many lines of code per bug in a typical software system, what would you guess the number is? Or if you like, so every so many lines, you're going to find a bug in a typical software system. What's your intuition about what the number of lines would be? 400?
400 is for the really million rep.
You said 10. Yeah, 10 is about right. Or at least 10 conforms to the measured data. The measured data has to be treated with suspicion because it relies on the honesty of the reporters, and people don't like to admit to having bugs. So if we sort of think about the incentives in bug reporting, that's going to lead us to believe that if the public number is 10, the real number has to be smaller than that. The bug rate has to be higher than people will admit to. And I don't know what the data collection methods are. I know that several different collection methods have been used, and they all converge on the same number. So perhaps 10 is about right. Now, any guess? Does it matter what programming language you use?
Yes.
I did ask for a guess. Is that a guess, or do you have reason to think that's
a guess? Okay. I would think that
just an example, Jeff was in? Okay, that's a slightly different question. That's a question of, can we improve the number of bugs that are caught at compile time? And I agree, that's a hugely promising technology. That doesn't change the baseline error rate. What it changes is the number of errors that survive into the compiler. And I think that's hugely important. But what I asked was, using a different kind of source language, does that somehow qualitatively change the problem? C versus Java versus something else? Oh, I'm sorry. I mean to assume that the programmer is competent in the language they're using. So a competent C programmer versus a competent Java programmer, we'll suspend disbelief about that. Do they have different error rates? Any data to support that assertion? Okay, fair. That's good. I mean, it's good to admit that, but just be clear when you're speaking, at least to yourself, whether you're making an assertion or whether you're quoting a fact. We can imagine hypothetical languages.
So that would be honest, my point is that it'd be really hard to program well in that language.
So the data is, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, especially
characterize that as useless?
Well, it's limited application. To,
it turns out when dtrace is the tool you need, it's the only tool for the job.
Oh, absolutely. No. But since D is so limited, it was in average there.
Except that the application of D is much more dangerous, so the price of being wrong is really a lot higher. Okay, fair enough. So it turns out there is a slight difference, but it is not in the large scale significant. Okay? The evidence is that switching programming languages will change your error rate measured in bugs per line of code by as much as 10%. No huge silver bullet here. And actually, there's some question about the variance in the measurements. There are obviously groups that are better than other groups, and one of the ways that they're better is their error rates are lower. And one of the problems with these comparative measurements is there's no way to really normalize for the quality of the groups you're sampling. It might turn out to be the case, because it's a dying language, whose remaining programmers are diehards and deeply experienced and are getting paid a premium for their experience, that the reason the error rates are slightly lower in Ada than they are in C, and emphasize slightly, is that the pool of surviving programmers in Ada is more experienced. But think about what that means, right? It means given a choice between writing in assembly language and writing in C, you're much better off writing in C, because each line says more. Theory seems contraindicated. Yes, you hit toggle switches, find a new employer. Part of what this says is a system. There's a huge bulk of code that does application-oriented processing, and then there's some core of the code that does control and management function. It organizes the rest of the computation. It makes dispatching decisions. It makes protection decisions. It makes resource allocation decisions. And if I have to have a choice about where to put a bug, I'd much rather put it in an application than in the control plane. Because if I take out the control plane, I take out the whole machine. If I take out on Internet Information Server, I can always restart it. I proved by example. So, if I want to reduce the number of errors in a piece of code, what is the highest yield way to go about reducing the number of errors in a piece of code? Test cases. So these numbers on error rates assume that you've written test cases. These numbers assume you've done code review. These numbers, by the way, do not seem to apply to stuff that's been through software verification. But even if we check all 10 examples of that, it's not clear that we have a statistical universe yet.
Use it in C,
right. So this is the patch and pray approach. What we're going to do is we're going to throw it onto the 777, and we're going to see how many United passengers we can lose. If you're Frontier, you might be willing to run this experiment this week, because you've only got 24 hours to live anyway. And, you know, what's another $1 trillion worth of creditors at this point? Because they're going bankrupt tomorrow anyway. You as a customer of the airline might find this objectionable. And testing is a funny thing. Testing and actual observed use in the field are a funny thing. What you discover is that there are well-worn paths through programs, and you will tend to debug those pretty robustly. What you won't debug is corner cases, and then 5 years out, after the developer who built the code is dead or missing, You know, somebody will trip a bug in some undocumented corner, and there you are. And in particular with things like flight controls, you know, not the straight and level flight case that you're really worried about, because that one's going to be well exercised, right? It's the, my Airbus has to evade your Cessna because you took off the wrong runway. How many times are we going to exercise that code in the field?
Hopefully,
man. By the way, if we get it wrong, right, how expensive is the 777? These are really pricey tests to run. Okay, so what else can we do? Right, just the number of lines of code. Used to be said of APL that it was a write-only language. That distinction has been taken over by Perl. It is possible to write readable programs in Perl. Pretty observed in the wild. But more seriously, I mean, so let's talk about reasonable language. Not that I have a strong opinion here, but I mean, maybe the answer is write a lot of stuff in Python. Is that?
Camel.
What? You know, you're taking advantage of the fact that I can't come after you with my favorite rejoinder in public. Okay, a camel is fine if you like threading needles with gum. How does that help me if what I have to write is an operating system? Coming back to the alleged topic. Can you write an operating system in Python? Or Perl, but let's... yes, but you were, that doesn't change the fact that you were right. Can I write an operating system in Python?
A small, silly operating system, sure.
How big is the Python runtime? I mean, the thing about Python is it's a glue language, right? Python in and of itself is near as damn useless unless you have a large body of C code to glue it to. That's an exaggeration, and I apologize to Guido if he listens to the recording, because it's not true. But it really is the case that in most applications, right, we're going to call out to the SSL library, we're going to call out to the TCP stack, we're going to call out to a bunch of other stuff that for performance reasons is written in C. Now, the good news is it's often, you know, very contained with well-specified interface, C code, right? The SHA-1 implementation is written in C. It is actually something you can test fairly exhaustively. Then there is the Python interpreter. And the Python interpreter, by the way, is a remarkably clean and beautiful piece of work. It's approximately the same size as a respectable microkernel. Certainly wouldn't reject out of hand, for some systems, building a system in Python. There are issues of predictability that might argue against it for certain applications. But don't forget the fact that these languages have runtimes, and the runtimes are generally not implemented in Python, they're implemented in C. And all of that stuff has to be right before you can rely on the safety properties of the language. And the only example of a system I know of in which the runtime was written mostly in the language itself is a system called VLISP. And I encourage you, you will not process these papers, but if you Google for VLISP pre-scheme, what you'll discover is these guys did a scheme implementation in which the runtime itself is written in a constrained subset of scheme that can be pretty much directly translated to machine code, but because it is within the safe language, they know it has safety properties. Very, very small bit of assembly down at the bottom, but it's measured in tens of instructions. Okay, so argument, which we'll pick up on Wednesday. If I want to build a system that's robust, the key is two things. One, reduce the amount of code that's critical down to something that I can exhaustively analyze. And exhaustively here means, among other things, I have to be able to keep the entire comprehensive design of that subset, you know, in the engineer's head. Because you're going to work over in one corner and it's going to touch things at the other end of that system. And it's got to be small enough to fit in your head. That's actually the more constraining size. Your head turns out not to be very big for this kind of stuff. Just stretch over time, but not that much. And the other is introduce structural barriers so that a failure in a non-critical part of the system cannot take out a critical part of the system. That's where we're going to talk about protection in the virtual memory sense or in the language safety sense, not in the access control sense. Although it's good if we can get them connected together. So the argument about microkernels ultimately is an argument about system structure. And it's that if you want robustness, structure is the key. Because you can't get perfect code. If you can't get perfect code, the next best thing is engineerable code, and that you can get. You can't get good engineerable anything without structure. Pick up Wednesday, and I'm happy to stay for questions. I apologize for running slightly past the hour.